I'm Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic.
And
my God-given sobriety date's October the 19th of 1982. And just a couple things, because I'd really like to get into the work. Number one, if I lived down here, I'd weigh about 300 pounds in about 6 months. You all got incredible food and like to eat large amounts of it. I really want to thank you for extending and making me feel real welcome. And I'll talk more about that when we look at step 12, but it's wonderful to come down where I see a lot of fire in the belly about this program. And, you know, I've got a chance to interact with a lot of you in several areas, and I guess one thing I just want to talk about, it sounds to me in talking with a lot of you that perhaps many times what you've done is gone back and you turned this into that four-step program I talked about yesterday. And Joe really summed the whole thing up. This is a spiritual process. And for me, every time, I will spend more time on that first step than almost any other step, because that's going to be the foundation of going back through that whole process. And in there again, continually, I always find my truth, you know, over and over and over again. And I think that's real, real important. And I'm not afraid of the truth today. The other thing I can tell you is, the longer I'm around this program, the less I know. And I'm very, very comfortable with that today. You know, the very best, I was sharing this with somebody. When I do prayer and meditation in the morning since I've been down here, you know, I say, God, Mark and Joe are two extremely pitiful, sick human beings coming to you, and we need your help to use us as agents to try and help your kids. And see, that's all we are, you know. We have experience to share. What the book has done for me has given me a vehicle to go in and find my truth and to gain access to that power. You know, no more, no less. I mean, one of my favorite titles to a book is, if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him. I mean, if you want to separate yourself from God, like I said, just stick someone in this program on a pedestal, because that isn't what it's all about. This friend of mine, Guy Reddall, has a saying which has helped me a lot. And in English, again, it means all my relations. And that means that everyone in here is the very same as me. They're my brother and they're my sister and no more and no less. So that's the place where I always try and come from with this thing. And I was kind of laughing to myself. I hate that when I have a guy that I sponsored and he's coming on 2 years sober, and he's like many of the men I sponsored, in and out of treatment 4, 5, 6 times, and around AA a little bit, and never making it work, and finally dropped his pride enough to come up and asked me to go through the work with him. I did that, and I found this has happened with guys I've worked with. It's like they get in some kind of massive state of grace, and their relationship with God is powerful, and so I'll go to them at times, or they'll do what spiritual gunfighters do, is they'll brutally confront me, like what happened to Joe. And, you know, he just recently did that. And number one, I always hate it when it's taking place, because my ego, you know, is real, real involved. I'm like, Joe, you know, I gave him all this stuff, and he's doing this to me. You know, like I was talking to a guy last night, he used the phrase about 5 times to me, and I said, why don't you turn that around and indicate in there that you drove that person away? But then what I hate even worse is they go back to your home group and tell everyone how they helped you. Anyhow, I want to move along through this thing. We've covered a lot of material, and there's a bunch more to cover. And we took a hard look in the first 43 pages. First part of that thing is simply it's craving, and we didn't care how much you drank and how old you are and whether you're 15 years or whether you're 90 and whether you're rich or poor, male or female. We just said, what happened when I stuck booze in my body? And we got rid of all the other stuff, and then we had 20 pages looking to that thing. The main problem centers the mind rather than in the body. And we looked at the idea that we had lost power and choice and control, no mental defense. And there were no subtitles. I have a mental defense because I'm 22 years sober and a nifty guy. That's not in there. It never will be in there. And then we looked at the second step and a couple of real key questions. And something I think real important for those of you who've been around and going back through the work, and that's this thing of asking God to lay aside prejudice. To lay aside prejudice. And finally, it asks you in that chapter, it begs you to lay it aside. And we looked at two primary questions in there. You know, one is, am I willing to believe? And then the second was, is my choice? God's going to be everything or nothing. And every time through the work, I always say he's going to be everything, but I never really know what that means until I'm down the road a little bit. You know, and then we took a hard look at the ABCs, and we took a look at the third step, and we get into the root of our problem. And we find out that there's absolutely nothing we can do about the root of our problem. And then we make this decision only. And Joe talked about the six words we got to look at: director, principal, father. And I'm going to be his actor and his agent and his child. And then we do that prayer. Then we went through the inventories and we take a look at that, and we got to get at the things that are blocking us. And we looked at an inventory, as the book says. It's a four column, and I write down and I don't write across, and I don't use little check marks. We looked at a fear inventory, and then we looked at a sex inventory. And so that's the place that we find ourselves today. And so we get done with that, and I'm on page 70, if you got a book and want to follow along. And tells me if I've been thorough about my personal inventory, I've written down a lot, listed and analyzed my resentments. I've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. I've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. I have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even my enemies, for I look on them as sick people. See, the book has asked me to shift my attitude. Instead of saying, "She did this to me," I go to God in a prayer and I say, "This person is spiritually sick." See, here's what I know. Not one person on the planet has ever woke up one morning and said, "You know what? I'm going to get Mark today." What happens is, on this level of spiritual growth, we're just all at different stages. The sicker I am spiritually, the more mistakes I'm going to make. Did I intentionally wake up with the idea of ever harming anyone? No. I'm spiritually sick. As I get closer to God and as I spiritually evolve, that begins to change for me. I've listed the people I've hurt by my conduct, and I'm willing to straighten out the past if I can.
There's a key statement. If I can doesn't mean on my own power. In the middle of a fourth step, or in the middle of the first step, or getting ready to do a fifth step, you're well aware of that inventory that you've written, and you start thinking about some of those amends, and you think once again, you're the one that's going to have to muster up the power to get yourself through those amends and go back to those people that you're still afraid to face. And some more power does not come into your life to move you between 5, 6, 7, and 8. You will not go make those amends. If I can doesn't mean dependent on me.
In this book, you read again and again, faith did for me what I couldn't do for myself. We hope that you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. That's a powerful sentence. Self-will cannot remove self-will. If you've already made a decision, third step, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, fourth step, you've made a good beginning. They do that to me over and over. I do great work. I think I get to take a little time off, go on a vacation, and all they tell me is I've made a good beginning. That being so, I've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about myself.
There they are. They're reminding me of my intent for writing inventory once again, even now that it's done. I wasn't writing inventory. It's so sad when people say they wrote inventory and they found out all these patterns about themselves. Sure we do. Or you get in touch with your feelings. Or you see what you've done in relationships in the sex inventory. But they refer to what they find out in inventory like that's the main reason for writing inventory. The main reason for writing inventory, so you don't lose focus and you're using inventory to come up with a plan of how you're going to change yourself, is you're writing inventory to seek truth. I keep that intent in place while I'm writing inventory and each time I sit down to write inventory. We talked yesterday about this ego thing that'll go like this. You write a piece of inventory, your ego will go, "Oh, so that's what I was up to. So now I'll," and you're just recreating yourself in your own image. You're just coming up with a plan. You see, "Oh, I've been a little aggressive with my wife, so now I should be a little more passive." How do you know what God wants you to be? You give Him all of that, the good and the bad, in steps 6 and 7. It's not about writing inventory to come up with a plan of what you're going to do better. It's about writing inventory to seek truth about what's blocking you from God and asking Him to mold you when you move through 6, 7, 8, and 9.
Chapter 6, into action.
What does that mean? That doesn't mean...
What does that mean, into action?
That couldn't possibly mean into action.
Having made our personal inventory, What should we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude, step two, a new relationship with our Creator, step three, and to discover the obstacles in our path, step four. We've admitted certain defects. We've ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We've put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter.
I know sponsors that have made people they're working with read their inventory three times, once alone to themselves, once to God, and once to the person they choose to read it to. Let's move through this up to the bottom of 75 quickly. I'm going to touch on a few points, and Mark will touch on a few that I missed. I think the one is that the bottom of the page, the best reason for not skipping this step is if we do skip it, we're quite sure to drink. These are facts out of these people that wrote this experience. Or on the next page, 73, the idea if you're not really thorough and you've only looked at the worst items in your inventory and you've been kind of half-assed with your inventory and you only think you'd lost your egoism and fear or only thought you had humbled yourself, but you haven't learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense that these people found it necessary until you told someone else all your life story. Isn't it sad that those people that write life stories from all the instructions in four took one little statement to write a life story when they missed all the ways of writing an inventory and just wrote a life story? If you've done a thorough resentment, fear, and sex inventory, your life story is covered in your first big inventory. And whatever you miss, you're going to see the next time you write. And the next time you write, it's going to be a little less. My inventories aren't the size they were the first time. I think average, the first inventory in the first column, resentments, is about 200. But if you didn't do 200, that doesn't mean you weren't thorough. You were thorough with what came out of you. I've known other guys that had to do 2,000 just to get all that stuff out because they lived in their head. It's funny. Passive people write longer inventories because aggressive people lived out here and got most of it out. I've seen librarians with bigger inventories than gangsters. I told you about that kid that lived in England, France, Asia, South America, and North America yesterday, and we put his amends cards in piles by continent. He had five piles this big of written inventory that he had to get out because of where and how he had lived. We took a pile at a time. It took a while. He'll never have another big inventory like that ever again if he continues to take personal inventory. It talks about picking the right person. Here's an important statement. At the bottom of 73, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we are to live long or happily in the world. We think well before we choose the person or persons. I told you I'd show you where it says that. You can fist step with more than one person. It's an amazing experience. I've done it several times. One time, just for the hell of it, I picked an addict, a woman that I didn't trust, and a guy that I didn't think was alcoholic, and asked the three of them if the four of us could go through the steps together and read inventory to all three of them. Because by the time we got through inventory, I trusted the woman. I knew the addict was an addict and that I wasn't. And that the guy that I didn't think was alcoholic really was. There was a bond there by the time we got, and I read inventory to all three of them. And they read theirs to me. It talks about belonging to religious denomination, what they should do or what you should do. We have no religious connection, but we might want to talk to someone ordained by an established religion. I tend to choose alcoholics as the general rule because they know me. You can fool a priest or a rabbi or some of them. Search out your acquaintance. It's important to find. We'll find some guiding principles here. Closed mouth, understanding friend. Probably not a good idea to read inventory to an enemy.
Yeah.
We also don't want to reveal anything to somebody we're reading it to that might hurt them. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Wonder why we never hear this as a topic in a meeting. We must be hard on ourselves and always considerate of others. Usually the topic is the opposite. How we should be more considerate of ourselves and harder with others, right? That's one of my favorite buzzwords. Now, I need to do things to take care of myself, right? But for 30 years, everything I ever did to try to take care of myself damn near killed me. But now I know the things that I should do to take care of myself, right? Maybe if you do things to take care of other people, you end up getting taken care of, and the day when how you're feeling every moment isn't so important, you end up feeling better than how you felt when how you felt was very important all the time. Does that make any sense? That we should talk to the right person, that he be able to keep a confidence and understand what we are driving at. We decide who's to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, we're prepared for a long talk. Here's an interesting thing to think about before your next fifth step. Think about what you are about to do and why you have to do it, and explain to the person you're going to read to why and what it is you're about to do. That Native American man I was telling you about took me up to this 13,000 foot peak and sat me down and opened his book, pointed to that line, and he said, "When I come back to get you, I want you to tell me what it is you're about to do and why you have to do it," and then walked away and came back and got me in about 20 minutes. Tells you what to do. Pocket your pride, go to it. Illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Now the fifth step, promises. Isn't it sad when they trivialize the promises and say there's only 12? We found some great ones before the third step prayer. Now we're going to find some more. Once we've taken this step, and here's a key word, I ask people every time we're done fist stepping, have you withheld anything? I'll tell you a story because I don't think it'll scare this room, but I've told it some places and people thought I was kooky. The little Crip, ex-gang member, did his first and second fist step with me, but his second one, I read mine, and then he read his. He asked me a question at the end of mine. I asked him a question at the end of his. Have you withheld anything? And he simply said, there's nothing I'm consciously aware of that I have withheld from you. And I've experienced tremendous surges of power from within before. But this time I had these big picture windows in my apartment, and they were open, looking down onto the ocean. And in through these windows, I started to feel a sense of something flowing into the room. And me, it was like tickling me, and I started to laugh hysterically. And him, it scared him, and he was sitting there like this, trembling, and he thought I was laughing at what he was doing. And I said, did you feel that? And he said, yeah, I thought you were laughing at me because I was feeling it and thought I was crazy. And it lasted for about 3 or 4 minutes, and it was just something flowing into the delightment. It was delight, or whatever you want to call it. And it says, if we have withheld anything, we are delighted. And that's what I experienced that day. I experienced delightment flowing into the room. That's all I know how to put it into words. These promises I also experienced the first night I did my first fifth step with Don in Denver, 11 years ago. And then he took me to go speak and didn't tell me I was going to speak. Walked into a room, there was about this many people, and he said, you're speaking first. And I had just read inventory all day. I said, how do you do that? He said, you go in the bathroom, you say a prayer. I came out, and these promises came true standing in front of those people. I was able to look them in the eye. I was able to be alone that night when I went home at perfect peace and ease. My fears begin to fall from me. You'll begin to feel the nearness of your Creator. You've had certain spiritual beliefs, but now you begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. You'll feel you're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Now, anything you'd like to add before we return home?
Just a couple things. You know, we had mentioned on page 52, untreated alcoholism, spirituality. Well, I'll tell you another place I found it. Page 73, more than most people, Mark leads a double life. He's very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents a stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. What am I saying here? I'm walking into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, looking good, sounding good, going home and abusing the shit out of my family. What's going on? That's my spirituality. That's what's going on. If I'm seeking for truth, what I'm doing is coming into that meeting, I'm saying, I'm abusing my family. I'm not trying to present some stage character in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm looking for truth. And I've had to come face to face with this. It's another area in which I find my untreated alcoholism. What you see up here today is what you get. I always tell people, when you're trying to get someone to be a sponsor, if you can, ask them if you can go live with them about 3 days. We make that decision. It's life and death. We make that decision based on hearing someone in a meeting. Oh, I don't know about that. Seriously, go home and live with them 2-3 days. Then find out whether or not you want to go through the work. And if they say, no, you can't do that, I don't know, might be something wrong with that. You're all welcome to come stay with me anytime you want. But that's another place I find untreated alcoholism, my spirituality. If I'm walking into AA presenting my stage character, and I'm going out there, and I'm being dishonest at work, and a lot of other areas, what's going on? Bottom of the page, I must be entirely honest with somebody if I expect to live long or happily in the world. Great promise. If I'm entirely honest with somebody, I might be able to live long or happily in this world. I like that. Another part that's real important for me, such parts of our story we tell to someone who understand yet be unaffected. Here's what Don did for me. He'd never been to Vietnam. When it came time for me to talk about that piece of the work, Don knew something. I didn't know at that time. If he's never had any experience with it, how can he help me? He loved me enough to send me to a man who had been there, done the same things I did, and who had gotten free of everything that goes along with that experience. I was talking to a gentleman last night. When I go somewhere, if I was down here and I had something going on I had to work with, something had to get resolved, and I needed to seek counsel, my question, first question would be is, do you have any experience with this? I was doing some work not too long ago with a woman who, like me, was a slut and a whore. And she had a 62-year-old sponsor, been married for 35 years to the same man and never committed adultery. I said, I know why you're talking to me about this stuff. It's not to say that that woman can't help, but I think there's an important piece in here. I owe anyone I sponsor, if I don't have any experience, to send them to someone. I've done some work lately with a bunch of men been to penitentiary. I've never been to penitentiary. So they had some stuff around that. I did a little, and then I sent them to another man who had experience being in the penitentiary. I owe them that. And the part about person to persons, this time through the work for me, I've got a small group. It's 5 or 6 men. We'll see what happens. We'll see who really wants to do this. And I'm going to do my fifth step with the whole group, and I'll tell you why. The longer I'm around, that ego Joe's talking about, I need 4 or 5 people to help me see my fourth column. I need 4 or 5, not just one. Not just one. I want 4 or 5. Because I'll see all kinds of things that I could not see with just one. That's basically all I got. You know, when you look at the promises, I want to mention one other thing. When you look at all the promises that happened to me once I'm done with the fifth step, you're going to see this word feel over and over and over again. I can't think my way through the 12 steps. I can't think my way into a relationship with God. This is all about feel, that stuff that Joe talked about, where something happens in your gut, it goes zooming right past your head. These promises for me took place down here, not in my brain. Let's go ahead.
So you've done your reading. Sometimes it takes one session. Sometimes you might be, you know, depending on your schedule and your sponsor's schedule or whoever you're going to read it to, you might be 2 or 3 sessions. I would warn anybody about this. If you're working with somebody, see, I don't see, when somebody asks me to be their sponsor, and I also should say this, I work with people I don't sponsor. A lot of people that I don't sponsor ask me to take them through the steps. Just because, see, and the trick is, it doesn't matter what they call me. I do the same thing with the people I sponsor as the people I take through the work. But I take a lot of people through the work that don't call me sponsor. What I was going to say about that is, it's just as much of a commitment for me as it is for them. It's not a one-sided thing. If I can't be there, if I can't be committed to being there for them, and I can't take on the responsibility, you shouldn't be working with people. And here's the dangerous part. Don't make people you work with sit on a four-step that's done. That's the craziest, most painful, dangerous time that there probably is in the work, is when that four-step is done, it needs to be read. Don't make people wait weeks before you're going to listen to what they have written, unless there's extenuating circumstances. Nowadays, I finish a four-step, if who I'm working with isn't available, right, then I'm going to go read it to somebody. Even if I read it to the person I'm working with, too. Not a good time sitting on a four-step that's complete. Now, there's things you can do to go back through it and review resentment and review fear and review the sex inventory, focusing on harm, doing some eight-step work before you read your fifth step. If you have 4, 5, 6 days before the person you're working with is ready to listen to it, and just focus on harm, what you did to each of those things you're writing about that caused harm, and stay in that four-step writing. But now I've read it. What do? I return home, I find a place where I can be quiet. Carefully review what I've done. I look back through my four-step. Thank God from the bottom of your heart that you know him better. That's a strange statement. After just looking at self for 6 or 7 hours, or however long it took you to read, how can you say in the bottom of your heart that you know God better? I found two things the last time I did this. How do I know God better after looking at self and the manifestations of self for 5 or 6 hours? Because I know a lot more about what he isn't. And if I know a lot more about what he isn't, I know a lot more about what he is. I also have discovered a whole lot of stuff that blocks me from him. And if I've discovered a whole lot of stuff that blocks me from him, I must know him better and be closer to him. Take the book down and turn to the page which contains the 12 steps on 59. Carefully read the first 5 and ask if you have omitted anything. No reason somebody should be going past step 5 if they still have doubt about step 1. Matter of fact, I just thought of a guy. If you have omitted anything, no reason somebody should be going past step 5 if they still have doubt about step 1. Matter of fact, I just thought of a guy that thought he was clear in step 1, and we did 2, and we did 3, and he wrote inventory, and he read his fifth step. He returned home. It was in his fifth step review, returning home, he realized he's not an alcoholic, but he's a real addict, and he just went on with the rest of the work. Carefully review the first 5 proposals and ask if you have omitted anything for your building an arch through which you'll walk a free man at last. Remember a while back on page 47 and page 62, I told you it was real important to look at the cornerstone and the keystone. Well, if you weren't thorough and you didn't look at those things, and the cement, which we actually didn't talk about, which is covered on page 17 of There is a Solution, which talks about there's 2 parts to the cement, not only sharing in a common problem, but sharing in a common solution. If you haven't been thorough with who you are working with or your own personal work up to the end of this fifth step, and you read the rest of this paragraph, you're going to be a little confused, because now they're going to ask you to review the work you've done so far. Is your work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? What are my stones? My willingness to believe at the second step on page 47 and my third step decision on page 62. Am I clear on those? So I review my second step and I review my third step decision. Have I skimped on the cement? To me that means, am I trying to get recovery with just fellowship? Or am I trying to get fellowship with just recovery? Because there's two parts to the cement, sharing in a common problem in the fellowship and sharing in a common solution in the recovery process. Am I trying to make this cement without sand? Am I trying to get one without the other? Am I trying to get recovery without fellowship or fellowship without recovery? You review those questions. I like to review those questions once the day I get home, and then I like to review them again the next morning, because usually when I return home from a fifth step, I'm drained. So I'll look them at it. I'll look at them, and I'll encourage you to look at those questions in that paragraph as many times as are necessary, and not to rush through that until you can answer the sentence on the top of the next page. And all it says is, when you've answered those questions to your own satisfaction. Now, talk about a major shift in the book. They made a statement on the previous page that you might have had some spiritual beliefs, but now you begin to have a spiritual experience. From all the negative stuff they've said about we can't trust our own mind, we have no power, we can't save ourselves, up to page 75, selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, all these kind of, I don't like to use the word negative, but all these kind of things they've said about us, that why people sometimes say that I'll speak somewhere and someone will say, well, your message is not really kind. Well, my message comes from the big book and it's not kind. I don't think they thought a lot about how we were going to feel about what they wrote as they were writing it. Guy said to me one time, though, the message he carries is a mother's kiss compared to what whiskey does to us. So I do returning home as many times as I need to. Sometimes it's been once. It's been as many as three or four times over three or four days until I did move on. And the shift I was talking about, now we're going to see where it starts to instruct you to trust. Not trust yourself, but trust something, because I think they're assuming you're not kind of really alone anymore. Because now they're asking you to trust when you've answered those questions to your own satisfaction. Now let's look at step 6. Anything about returning home?
No.
Okay, let's look at some questions. First, they make a statement that willingness is indispensable. I missed that 4 or 5 times through the steps. The most I ever got from that was, okay, my willingness is important. I never saw why it was indispensable in these next set of questions until I'll tell you what happened. Let's look at 3 questions. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things I have admitted are objectionable? Question number 1. Question number 2. Kenny, now, people say there's not much to 6. There are some major, major questions here that really need some consideration. Kenny, now take them all, every one. Never really had a problem with that, but we add one from the ABCs and from the 12 and 12 to Kenny. And I'd like you to write it in there if you think it's important, as Willie, for me, as I am with what I've just admitted, with cake on my face, with all this stuff I've just admitted over the last several hours to whoever I read to. Not Kenny. We probably, most of us, know from looking around that he can. But I like to put in there, it kind of takes me to the experience of the first word of the 7th step. It kind of takes me from really eager and anxious to humbly when I just sit with, will he for me, just like I am with all my stuff. Now, the clincher. If I still cling to something that I'm not willing to let go, I ask God to help me be willing. There's a question there you need to ask yourself. It's real obvious. Is there anything I'm not willing to let go of? And the time this happened for me, the thought came, dummy, go back through your inventory, and if you can find anything, behavior, beliefs in the 3rd column, defects, anything you did in the 4th column, anything in the 2nd column, anything in that total inventory that you can currently think of that's going on in your life that you're not willing to let go of, write it down. And I wrote it down. You know how there was about 6 things? Masturbation, judgment, trying to run my home group.
Can't imagine that.
You can't imagine that I would try to do that?
That was a joke, Joe.
I forgot the rest, conveniently. I'll find them again. And I wrote them down. Then the next thought was, read the questions you just went over again. And the answers changed, because I'll go through it again and tell you how it went the first time. I usually return home more aware of my defects than when I left the house from a fifth step. Some people come out of a fifth step thinking they're supposed to be free of their defects. No, they're usually just really, really glaring, right? And I come home and I got this desperation, this sense of, I want to get rid of this stuff, and I want to get rid of it now. The questions kind of bring me like a long breath. Especially the one, will he? But here's what I did. I read, we've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Slough that off. Okay, it's important. No big thing. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things I've admitted are objectionable? Based on how I felt, I said, yes. That was not based on truth. I based my answer on how I felt. I sold myself short. I said, yes. Can he now take them all, every one? Sure. Will he for me? I had to think about it for a minute, and I said, well, yeah, I'm willing to believe that he will for me. But then when I read, if we still cling to something that we're not willing to let go of, we ask God to help us be willing, and the thought came to go back through the inventory and write down anything that I wasn't willing to let go of, behavior, beliefs, defects, anything in there that I could see. And I wrote down those six things, and then the thought came, read the questions again, here's how the answers went. After seeing there were some things that I wasn't willing to let go of. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things that I've admitted are objectionable? No. Can he now take them all, every one? I don't know. Will he for me, as I am, unwilling to let some stuff go? I don't know, but I'm willing to believe that he will. And my next thought was, now I see why willingness is indispensable. Because of my unwillingness to let certain things go. And I had a new experience with when ready. I always thought when ready meant that I was all cleaned up and all willing and answered yes to all these questions and a good little boy to stand before God. And that time I wasn't. And I saw that was just as ready as any other time because I'd been honest. And when I answered those six-step questions based on my feelings, they were totally different than when I answered them based on truth, that there were still some things I wasn't willing to let go of. The next time with the Native American man, when I was a big boy, when I'd grown up a little bit, and I had two or three things I wasn't willing to let go of that he talked to me about, he said, you're a big boy now, we're not going to mess around. You being unwilling to let anything that you're currently doing go is a game, and you sit with those things that you've written down until you are willing, and made me stay with step six until when ready meant when ready. So I've had lots of different experiences, but with when ready, one time meant that there were some things I wasn't willing to let go of, and that could, in God's eyes, be ready, because I was honest. And another experience with the Native American man, when ready meant there wasn't anything I wasn't willing to let go of. And he made me sit with step six, and I think it was 5 days, and those were not wonderful days, realizing that I was still holding on to some things that I had admitted were objectionable. So, each time it's been a very private, it's been a very personal experience. I don't think Bill spent a lot of time on it because his ego probably wasn't in the way, and it's an experience as it probably was 13 years later when he wrote the 12 and 12 after a few years of LSD with Father Ed and all that stuff. When he had a lot more ideas. Although there are some great ideas in the 6th and 7th step and the 12 and 12, I tend to find all I've needed and challenge my stuff so far with these two paragraphs, although I've read the 12 and 12. It's always been kind of a private, quiet experience. I don't think I've ever done the seventh step, except our meeting closes with it. I don't think I've ever formally done my seventh step with someone else. I've always been kind of instructed to do it alone with God. And the funny thing is, I've never felt alone doing it. And I, when ready, and like I said, when ready has meant different things, I do the seven-step prayer. I'd like to ask Mark if he has anything to add, and then maybe we can just say that prayer together.
Not much. Joe covered that real well, and I've had a lot of that same experience. If there's one area that I've gotten massively confused on in my journey through this program and this work, it's this. And you go to meetings and 12 by 12 studies, and we just analyze and dissect, and it just amazes me. And I think finally last year through the work, I had some of the experiences Joe was talking about, and I guess it's just gotten real simple for me anymore. And some of that was in the last time through. The message I got in some meditation was real clear, and that is that there's a couple questions you answer in here, and you look at this issue of willingness and some truth, and beyond that, this step and the seventh step are all about God, and you're never going to understand God because you're not God, you're Mark. And so I don't analyze any of that stuff anymore in the steps 6 and 7, and I haven't picked up 12 by 12 in a long time. I went through there, and there were some things I read at times, and this is just for me, because it gets me too much into analyzing what I believe are steps where God does most of the work. And that's really all that that I have to say. I like Joe, I think this time through, when I always find some things I'm unwilling to let go of, and one of them I've learned a long time ago, and every time when I get here, I know it's going to be there, so I've taken it for granted, but I think next time through I might have a chance of not taking it into it. And that for me is lust. You know, I love that sometimes when I'm doing some work with some guys and we get here, and is there anything you're not willing, you know, to let go of? No, absolutely not. Really? What about lust? Oh, and that opens up a few more, but I think he described real well what that process is about, and as I said, for me, I really had to stop analyzing 6 and 7. Because the bottom line is, there's a couple little things that I do, and then I look at, and it's through prayer, and then I take that stuff to God in that step, and then I move forward. It's into action. I had some people come to me recently. Their sponsor had told them to take 2 months on step 6 and 2 months on step 7. Can you imagine that, after just doing the fifth step and having all that stuff, and all I could tell them was, well, my book doesn't say anything like that. I personally felt that those instructions were massively dangerous. I went over what was in the book, and I told them to go back to the sponsor, and then they move forward through that. So, Joe?
What about this one? My sponsor told me to return home, do 6 and 7, make a list of my character defects, and then put them. I went back and sat with my sponsor, and we put my defects in the order that we were going to work on them in. I'm working 6 and 7, right? And today I'm working on dishonesty. And today I'm working on unselfishness. And it's like it turns into a carnival game, that thing that you bang this one down, and then this one pops up, and then you bang that one down, and then this one pops up. You know, if I could remove my character defects and work on my character defects, then I would be God. You want to know when you've done 6 and 7? When you're working on 8. You want to know when you're done with step 8? When you're knocking on somebody's door doing a 9th step. You want to know when you've done 3? When you got a pen and a piece of paper and you're doing 4. You want to know when you've done 3? That's what I just said. Now we need more action. Dang it. Without which we find faith without works is dead.
The prayer.
Oh. Let's do the prayer.
We'll do the prayer.
My Creator.
My Creator. I am now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
We just finished the prayer we started at step 3. That's the amen that ends it. Now we move into a new prayer. And I think that's appropriate because we move out. We've really been on a journey that went in, came out a little bit sharing it with somebody else. Now we're really going to go out to the world and repair the damage done in the past. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. I had to reconcile that one of the times through the steps because it didn't fit with my conception of God that I chose. Because the God that I chose, I don't have to do anything to deserve or earn faith from Him or in Him. And the way I reconciled that was I read some stuff and I realized the work that I must do so my faith doesn't die isn't to appease God or make Him happy. It's to appease my own soul. I'm also not making amends to please God, nor doing any of this work to please God. One of the paradoxes for a guy like me, and some of you, is that the paradox is you have to do a lot of work in AA to find out it's none of the work you're doing in AA. That grace is free and undeserved. And I think I'd kind of like to take a minute to talk about a form of denial that I don't think I'm any different than any alkie in this room or any more special or any better. And I don't think it's common just to me because I've talked to several friends and they've had it too. And I don't hear it talked about in AA. And it's a form of denial that it's 7.5 years and several other times not knowing I was in it. And I'm sure sometimes from in the future I'll be in it again. It's a form of denial I don't hear talked about. And it's a form of denial stronger than the denial I came here to AA with, that we do hear talked about. And that form of denial that we do hear talked about, obviously, is the denial of the disease of alcoholism. The only disease that tells you you don't have one. All that stuff, and we talk a lot about that. This other form of denial, I don't hear talked about. And here I was, 7.5 years sober, and I'm writing inventory. Now, I don't know what I was writing about. But as so many times, off the end of my pen comes something that has nothing to do with what I'm writing about, and I go, holy moly. And I realized I was in a form of denial that I wasn't aware that I was in. And that in me it comes out real subtle sometimes. And sometimes it comes out not so subtle. The subtle ways would be like, I don't know if they do it here, but you get up to take a birthday cake in California, 5, 10, whatever year it might be, and someone in the back of the room will go, how did you do it? And isn't that real subtle? Isn't that real subtle? And I get up and I say, my name's Joe and I'm an alcoholic and I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable, but then you spend 10 or 15 minutes telling them how you keep yourself sober and manage your life. Sometimes it's not so subtle. Sometimes it's me in the middle of an inventory writing some stuff where I see that I'm taking the credit for what I've been given, and it's no longer a free, undeserved, unearned gift. It's now something in words. Watch out for these words if they start to creep into your mind or if they start to come out in the people you're working with. Now that I'm such and such sober, now that I'm 7.5 years sober, I deserve, or now that I'm 7.5 years sober, I have the right to. It's no longer the grace of God. It's now something you've earned or deserved. And you know what you're in? The absolute denial of the grace of God. Taking the credit yourself. So there's another one of the paradoxes that we've discovered on our journey this weekend. If you admit you have no power, you receive more than you've ever been given. If you look at maybe you're not an alcoholic, you might find out you really are. And to come to believe, you don't see where you believe, you see where you don't believe to come to believe. And if you decide to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, we're going to find out here in a minute, you get a whole new life and a will that you can begin to use properly. You don't lose your will in your life. Now we've discovered another paradox in that I lost it. in that you don't do the work of Alcoholics Anonymous to keep yourself sober or earn anything or deserve anything from God. You just have to do a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous to realize it's not all the work you've done in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's another paradox. So now we move into 8 and 9. A lot of people make a list when they're doing a fifth step. I do that now too. But I also have people go back through their inventory and find anybody we missed while we were making this list on this blank piece of paper while they were reading their fifth step. But it says we made it when we took inventory. We have a list of people we have harmed, to whom we will become willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. There's a prayer. Remember, it's a good time to remind us this. Take you right back to why you're here, why you're making amends, why you're doing this work. Takes you right back to the first step. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that you would go to any length for victory over alcohol. It's a good time to reaffirm that. It's a good time to reaffirm. And here's a great question I'll give you that was given to me as you move into amends. And here's the question. Does making these amends have anything to do with whether I drink again or not? Yes or no? Now we'll talk about the eighth step and we'll take a break. What I'd like to say about the eighth step is, from what you know of me from this weekend, and we read the short form of the step itself, which I think in some cases we've overlooked this weekend, you find those that work the steps from the short form have very little to do with reading the long form, and those that work the long form spend very little time on the short form. That's just the way it is. But the short form of the eighth step does say, made a list of all persons, I like to add to that, and institutions, we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. From what you know about me from this weekend, what would you say that I would say is the most important and overlooked word in the eighth step? Bingo. The most overlooked word in the eighth step. Now, has this book ever asked you to become willing to do something that they don't ask you later to do? No. Has this book ever asked you to become willing to do something they haven't later asked you to do? Or are we supposed to just sit there and say we're willing? We become willing and then we do it. So the most overlooked word in the eighth step is not to just become willing to make amends to them all, but to make amends to them all. I was told, go home, work on my list. Once again, that stupid direction, work on the list until you know it's done. I was so tired of making lists, by the time I got through the eighth step, I couldn't stand it. Here I am once again working on a list. When I got the list done, he gave me an exercise. I thought this exercise came from the Colorado State Penitentiary, because he was locked up when he was given this exercise. I didn't know it's mentioned in the next paragraph. And the exercise was, when the list is done, go through the list one at a time, closing your eyes and picturing that person or that institution, and asking yourself one question. Am I willing to do whatever this person or institution might ask for me to make right the wrong? And mark it, plus or minus. He said that exercise lifted him up and set him free before they let him out of the Colorado State Penitentiary while he was still locked up. He got free. I didn't know that the next paragraph in the big book says, probably there are still some misgivings.
and asks us to look over the list of business acquaintances, friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. So I'm looking over the list, finding out which ones I have misgivings about by marking them plus or minus. Whatever comes to you, trust it. Don't try to change it. You get to somebody's name, and you picture that person, and what comes to you is, no, I'm not willing to do whatever they might ask me. Mark it, minus. If it comes, I'm willing to do whatever this person might ask, mark it, plus. So I asked Don later, how do I get the willingness to do the ones I put a minus by? What do you think he said? Do the ones you put a plus by. And believe it or not, every time I've had a pile of ones I'm willing to do that I mark with a plus, and I have a small pile of ones I'm not willing to do that I have a minus by, before the plus pile is done, the minuses have turned into pluses. So then I'm told to take my list, after doing this exercise, put each one on a 3x5 card, and it should look like this. Here's how the card should look. In the upper left-hand corner, name, address, phone number. If you have none of that information, their name and the word find. In the upper right-hand corner, plus or minus. On the rest of the card and the back, and as many cards as you need to staple to it, in some of your cases, the rest of the harm that you're aware of you caused that person. I'm sorry, not the rest. All of the harm you're aware of that you caused that person. And there I got that card for that person, and my 8th step is done. Once I get the cards on every amends that I'm currently consciously aware of. Mark?
And there's just one other thing in the 8th step that I do every time. It's been important, and that is that I ask God to show me people that I harmed that have never showed up in any inventories. See, in my life, I've always had people who did the right thing, irregardless of my behavior.
That I didn't resent, but I harmed.
Exactly. And there have not just been one or two. That's a real important prayer for me as I go through. I'll share my last experience, which was recent around this, is two names came to mind. One was my grandmother. Now, I've written a lot of inventories, and I know why that came to mind, because I was a second born in this family, and I was her favorite, and she did many things for me, and she helped me financially in some respects. And what happened is I'm up in Alaska, and I get a call that she'd been put in a nursing home about age 90, and I get a call that she was real sick, and so I hop on a plane, and I wound up somewhere in St. Louis. I met a girl on a plane, and I show up 5, 6, 7, 8 days later. I can't remember now. Not only had she died, but I missed the funeral. And in all the inventories and everything I'd done, that never came up. Well, that came up last time. And needless to say, there's some harm in there. I never had a resentment toward that woman. And what that's going to be about for me is hopping a plane going to Humboldt, Iowa. I had the very same thing come up with a great aunt, her sister, who although was not as involved in my life, did many of the same things. I had the same opportunity to spend some time with her in a nursing home. I did not do that. This is a woman whose every act toward me was one of kindness and love. She has never showed up in any one of my inventories. She is also in that same graveyard back in Humboldt, Iowa. And again, this is for me. I will go back there, and I will visit their grave sites, and I will get free of that. So that's a very, very important piece for me when I get to the 8th step. God, please show me anyone that I may have harmed by my conduct that is not on any of my inventories.
Let's do a 3x5 card on the board. So I've made my list for my inventory. Then I've prayed and asked God to show me any amends I owe that didn't make my inventory. The shorter the inventory, the more work you have to do with step 8. Especially if your first inventory was a short one. Don't skip on the work with step 8 because your inventory might not have been thorough and you just needed to get out what came out and rush and get through the work and get into amends. You do some more work on 8 than you didn't do on 4. Guy came to our group. I'm not jumping ahead, but I wanted to say this before we move on. Well, let's do this card. In the left-hand corner, I put their name. Your name. These are the amends I'll have to make to you before we're done today for all I put you through.
Now we want to put name, address, and phone number, but just put those words. No, under it, in the corner. Address, phone number. Steps 13, steps 10 and 11, we're going to look from I'm sorry, can we stop the tape for a second?